And let's say you have five diagnoses and only one of them has been accepted as an NDIS qualifying diagnosis, but all of them need hours with a psychologist. How are you supposed to slice up those hours into which ones go to this disability, which ones go to that one?
I think this is where that kind of sausage making between the letter of the law, of legislation and the reality of people's lives gets very difficult to square sometimes.
I want to ask both of you this question. Based on the legislation as it stands, does it need more amendments? Hi, I'm Dr. George Stolopoulos, and welcome to Reasonable and Necessary, Australia's premier podcast series on the National Disability Insurance Scheme, brought to you by the Soul Foundation. I'm coming to you from Wurundjeri land, and pay my respects to elders, past, present, and emerging. But before we go any further, please do me a favour and hit the like button, subscribe to the channel, and select the notification bell so you can be notified of future episodes. In this episode, we're unpacking the latest amendments to the NDIS bill with the Director of Policy and Advocacy at Dana L. Gibbs and Mitchell Skipsey, Senior Solicitor from PIAC. We find out what these amendments might mean for NDIS participants and what further amendments are needed to let the NDIS bill meet the needs of our community. Check it out. Hi, Ellen Mitch. Welcome to the show.
Hi, George. Good to be here.
Hi, George. Hey, Mitch.
Great to have you on talking about the NDIS bill. Let's start from the start. What is the purpose of the bill and what's it trying to achieve? I'll start with you, Elle.
It's a good question, George, because the legislation sort of feels like it landed from outer space a little bit. And, where did this really kind of technical changes to the NDIS legislation come from? Why now? What's the hurry? All of that. So certainly from the government's perspective, the NDIS review, even though they haven't given their formal response to it yet, they're keen to kind of get on with things. So there are some elements in the bill that respond to the NDIS review, but only some. But I think the main reason is that they are really worried about the extra costs of the NDIS. And I think that that is one of the biggest concerns across the whole government. In the last budget, they made a decision to put a target of the growth of the NDIS at 8% by 2026. And it doesn't feel like, that's only 2 years away. And so some of the elements that are in this bill are about how they go about that. But I don't think that's necessarily been how everyone's talked about it. So there's going to be lots of changes to the NDIS, to the way disability systems and supports work for all of us over the next 5 years, out of the Royal Commission, out of the NDIS review, and this is just the start. So it does feel like it's happened out of the blue, but behind the scenes, they've all been thinking about it and working on it for a while. This hasn't included any of us in those conversations until very recently.
Yeah, because it's become very clear that there's a lot of pressure from Treasury, isn't there, to address the cost of the scheme. And I'm hearing that people are worried that these changes might then lead to people either not qualifying or having their plans reduced. Is that what you think this bill is going to do?
No, I don't necessarily think this bill is going to do that, depending if we can get some amendments through and some changes. But I definitely think there are some parts of Treasury that don't like the NDIS. They think it's growing too fast. They think there are too many people getting support and they don't think it is a particularly effective system. So whether we agree with that or not is kind of not the point. Like, they have certainly put a lot of pressure on the review team. They put a lot of pressure on the government in terms of making decisions. So part of what I think it's important for all of us to understand is that, there is these pressures from inside the public sector as much as there is within government around change the NDIS. And, you know, for all of us, you know, we all know that things are growing very quickly. And, you know, I've said this a lot, you know, publicly, if I was confident that every single cent was getting to disabled people, I would be leading the charge against change, right? I really would, but I'm not. And I can't, hand on my heart, say that every dollar that we're spending on the NDIS is getting to disabled people. I just know that that's not true. So, but whether this bill is going to address those things and whether it's going to do things in a way that we want them to is a really live question. And I think that, like, I'm really glad we're having this conversation today.
Mitchell, you were on our show a couple of episodes ago with Darren O'Donovan talking about the bill. And one of the things that both of you said is that you wanted to see some amendments to this bill. And we've got some amendments. So how about you take us on a bit of a journey through those amendments, and how about we start with the definition of NDIS supports?
Yeah, sure, George. So this, the Section 10 that the new amendments would insert into the NDIS Act that defines NDIS supports as a term, that was something that I think both Darren and I raised our eyebrows at, and that there's been a lot of public commentary about, because it, in its initial form, it did some pretty unusual things by sort of representing a couple of selected parts of the CRPD, the Convention on the Rights of People with Disability. Basically, that a lot of the concern I think that created was the way in which it could unreasonably or unfairly narrow down the range of things that could be NDIS supports, and also create a lot of really technical legal headaches that could sort of have echoes through the scheme by when you bring in part of an international convention but not the whole thing, it really does raise big legal question marks about how you interpret the rest of the Act. So Darren raised that in his submission, we raised that at PIAC in our submission, a lot of other people did in their submissions about the bill. And I think a really good thing about that is that government clearly heard that, and they've made a really positive amendment there. They've taken out those references to the convention. Instead, what they've said is that basically they've said the way NDIS supports will now be defined is through the rules, and they've put in certain kind of constitutional machinery to say that the rules do need to think about what can be constitutionally funded by the NDIS. But they've basically said that's the minister's homework.
Mitchell, just to be clear, one of the things that lots of us had raised in our submissions around the bill in that Section 10, so this is a what's in and what's out kind of section, was that they were using what's called APTOS, which is the weird acronym, which is basically kind of like this basically piece of paper that the state and territory signed with the Commonwealth about who pays for what and where they've all argued about in the Administrative Appeals Tribunal and the Federal Court for the last sort of 6 or 7 years, and that they were going to keep using that even though it doesn't work and it makes really unfair decisions for people with disability, they were still going to do that. And we all went, no, that's a terrible idea. So they've said, yeah, we agree with you, and they've taken that out. That's what happened.
Well, first of all, they changed Section 10, and I think that was the first move. But then just earlier in the week, there were some further amendments that have come through that said, so APTOS was always meant to be retained as a transitional provision. I think that everyone recognised APTOS shouldn't stay in there forever, but the original draft of the bill, as well as that kind of, I would say, clunky Section 10, they also intended to have APTOS bridging the gap between now and when those new rules are made. Now, essentially, there are a lot of problems with APTOS. I think anyone who's read the APTOS table, most people within government, I think, who've had to deal with it in various sort of program spaces, can see that there are ways in which APTOS was unclear, it was unhelpful, it was causing major problems. And so it's really helpful that I think, as you say, Elle, is really helpful that they've taken out APTOS from that transitional role that it was going to play. Instead, APTOS is not going to do that anymore. What they've replaced that with is that, so we still need to draw up some rules to define NDIS supports. The government still needs to do that. And in the transitional period while those rules are being developed, the NDIS supports will not be defined by APTOS. It will be defined by a legislative instrument that comes from the minister. Now, I'm aware I'm talking in really real technicalities here, and I'm aware that a lot of this sounds really technical, but basically what that means is the minister will have a lot of power in that interim period to define what's an NDIS support and what's not.
I'm going to get Mitchell to explain legislative instruments to me anyway, George, whether you like it or not, at some point in this podcast, because I think it would be helpful for me anyway.
Well, I'm sort of doing that now.
I'm happy to talk about
this. Really good, because so as far as one of the things, just for you, George, you were part of the Senate committee hearings a couple of weeks ago. You gave evidence, I gave evidence, Mitchell gave evidence. We were all there to basically talk to senators about the bill and this issue around what's in the actual legislation. So what is actually passed by Parliament, the thing that they argue about, and then what is in the next bit. So the rules, which are the same thing as the legislative instruments that we talk about, but the rules. So one of the things in the current NDIS is there's lots of rules about the details of how things work. So I remember right at the beginning days of the NDIS, we were all arguing over rules of what's in the health, what should the health department pay for and what does the NDIS pay for. And some of it got quite specific in very strange ways. So the rules around this, there's lots of this legislation where the detail is all in the rules. And lots of us were arguing in these committee hearings that we wanted more of it actually in the legislation so that it was harder for future governments to change. And that it was more a have to, like you have to actually do this, rather than we'll figure it out at like behind closed doors and we'll figure it out away from you pesky lot, disabled people. Is that what they mean?
All right. Well, let me lay out some terminology here because unfortunately, we're going to have to get technical on some of these pieces. At the very top level of kind of the most authoritative kind of law we're talking about here is what's in the Act. That is the kind of the sometimes called the head legislation, sometimes called the statute, but the NDIS Act, that's the most authoritative thing that you're going to get. So you have the Act, and then the Act might say there are some details, and those further details need to be defined through through what's called delegated legislation. Now, there are two types of delegated legislation that we're talking about here. The first kind of delegated legislation is NDIS rules. There are lots of subtypes of NDIS rules. I'm not going to get into those, but the NDIS rules are basically things that help to fill in a lot of those gaps that are negotiated between the federal and the state governments. There are some checks and balances then between what goes into those rules, and they're often used to negotiate the parts of the NDIS where you need state and federal cooperation. So that includes things like which service will pay for what. It includes things where the state and territory governments and the federal governments are talking about budgetary numbers and how those sorts of costs will be shared. Okay, so again, top level, you have the statute. Second level down of maybe is the first kind of delegated legislation, the NDIS rules. The next level down, I suppose, in terms of the thing that has the kind of the least scrutiny on it and the least kind of supervision over it is just what's called a legislative instrument or a ministerial determination. So basically that's something that the minister can make on his own. He doesn't have to go to the states for permission. He doesn't have to go to the federal parliament. The minister has the right to make legislative instruments that just determine certain things.
Okay. So how do we find out about those things?
How do we find out what's in them?
Yeah.
Typically what happens is when the minister is going to make one of these determinations, the way that the NDIS Act establishes this and the way that the amendments or the bill would have this happen is that the minister would write up a determination. He would need to table it in the Senate, and then the Senate gets some time to look at it before it becomes law. So there's a bit of time while it's in the Senate where the senators can have a look over it and they can... If they see something really wrong with what the minister's written up, they can vote to disallow it. But if no one does anything, it sits tabled in the Senate for a bit, and then it becomes the law and it becomes an important part of the way that the NDIS works. So those are the three levels. Statute, NDIS Act at the top, NDIS rules as the sort of the second level down, negotiated between the feds and the states. And then the bottom level, the most flexible level, is things that are left just to the minister to then, you know, lob through Parliament's eye line, through the Senate, and then become law.
What's really interesting about that is I remember back in the day when we were creating the NDIS and setting it up, we wanted it to be there regardless of what the government of the day might think about the needs of disabled people and regardless of the economic situation. We wanted some assurance that the NDIS would be there for us. And so some of us are a bit nervous about what this change that you're talking about means. Is that fair, Mitchell?
Yeah, I think there's been a lot of commentary, including from in our podcast last time around, about the way in which, well, how will these legislative instruments, these really flexible things that give a lot of power to the minister, how are these going to get made? Basically, how can we be sure that the minister will do those things through appropriate co-design and consultation processes? Now, throughout this whole process, Minister Shorten and the government have been saying, we always intend that all of the things we can do by legislative instruments or by rules, we're going to be talking to people in the community about it. They've always said that that's the case. But I guess what a lot of us have been saying is, look, that's all well and good that you intend that, you know, that you've said that to us, but there will be other ministers that do this. This is a scheme and a set of amendments that we're setting up that needs to go forward in the future with some real stability behind it. So we're not just relying on kind of one-off decision-making, but that there's the right structures to be bringing in the voices of people with disability throughout. And so one of the amendments that we've been asking for here is to say, we think that there should be various requirements in the legislation, in the statute, that say whenever the minister makes one of these determinations, he needs to be talking to disability representative organisations. He needs to be tabling things with the Senate, putting in documents to the Senate saying, yep, I've done my homework. I've spoken with DROs. I've spoken with people with disability. Here's what they said. And that, we think, would provide the right kind of structural constraint on the minister and real requirement for the minister to be bringing in the right voices into those conversations.
And we, just on that co-design point, we've been really clear in the way that we've put amendments up about what co-design actually means, because I think there's a lot of lip service paid to, oh, we'll co-design this, when they actually mean perhaps we'll consult and maybe. But we've been quite clear about what we think that this means, where they must include the disability representative organisation. So these are the national peak organisations who are funded to do systemic advocacy as representatives of people with disability. And it's not always the same organisations each year, but there are a large number of organisations, you know, a variety of them. As of 1 July, I think there's going to be an extra 4 that are funded now to do this representative work. It's a wide range of people with disability, but having that kind of codified that they must go to those organisations has been part of what we've talked about. We also have put in things around public consultations and transparency. Reports back to both the NDIA, NUT has to make them public, about the impact of any of these changes. We've also talked about regular reports to Parliament. Like, we've been trying to, as part of our thinking about the amendments, trying to increase the transparency around these processes and increase the opportunities for us to both have a say but monitor the impact in a public kind of way. So, you know how sometimes government makes changes and don't think about it terribly well. They don't listen to what we say. The changes made, we all go, this is what's going to happen. And they go, no, it won't. No, it won't. And then 12 months later, something terrible's happened. And we, you know, this is a way of actually having opportunities for us to be able to change that as we go. So part of the thinking for, you know, Dana's submission, but also the one that we worked on with all of the other DROs, has been, what opportunities at each part of the bill do we have to incorporate both co-design, what we mean by co-design, but also these kind of transparency and accountability mechanisms at the different parts of the bill? And it's probably not, you know, super lawyery or like all of that. But it's kind of, this is what we need as a community in terms of changes to such a system that is of such incredible importance to people with disability across the country. Like, it's something that at every part of it, we must take deep care about changes. And putting these amendments in has been a part of trying to say, if you want to take deep care, these are some of the ways that you need to do it.
Now, I should say as well, I do think that there is an awareness within the government about the fact that this is a conversation that, you know, that the things that Elle is saying and the things that I'm saying here, because they have made some amendments and they have said some things publicly about their intention to do co-design work on this. And there were a couple of amendments that you might hear described as saying, oh, now there are, they've added in more kind of consultation requirements around and more co-design requirements around these legislative instruments. I suppose I would say that there have been some provisions added that say when the minister makes some of these instruments, he needs to be thinking about co-design and consultation. But frankly, there's not a lot of consequences for if he doesn't do his homework, or if he just says, yep, I've thought about it, that's a tick in the box. And really, I guess what I would say is I'd want to see something with a little bit more, a few more consequences than that, a few more kind of concrete steps that you can actually, people can look at it and say, yeah, I know that the minister did really do the co-design work there. And I know that because I can see it's written down in this statement, or that there's various sort of legal consequences for it. At the moment, that probably hasn't happened yet. And so that's something I'd be wanting to see going forward. Going back to what we were talking about then around Section 10, this definition of NDIS supports and the way in which that's going to be developed over time, there has always been an intention for NDIS supports, a lot of that definition to be done through NDIS rules developed between states, territories and the federal government. That's probably just something that has to be a part of the legislation. And they've now taken out, as we say, some of the awkward and clunky legal language that would have really made those discussions, I think, hard to have in the right way, and might have thrown off the way those rules would be developed. The big question that these amendments do raise is the transitional period while those rules are being written, which could be a couple of years. You know, it takes a long time for governments at state and federal level to work together on these things sometimes. That transitional period now will be covered by, not by APTOS, but by instruments, a determination made by the minister. And so what we really need to be looking at is some of the things we've just talked about. When the minister makes determinations, how do we make sure this bill is ensuring that he will do so in a co-designed way, in a way that is giving appropriate voice and engagement to the disability community? And so at the moment, there's not really much in the bill about that. That's one of the types of amendments and the types of questions that I think we'd want to keep pushing for.
Just for my benefit, Mitch, just so that I understand where we are in the sausage-making process of legislation, we've had some amendments that were tabled in the House last week or this week, and that have gone through, and they were tabled by the government. So in terms of that, and then the bill with the amendments from the government have now gone to the Senate, but the Senate's not going to look at that now until the 24th of June, which is the next time the Senate sits. But before that, we're going to have the report from the Community Affairs Committee on June the 20th. And that's going to hopefully pick up a whole bunch of the stuff that we all talked about to the committee and recommend a bunch of other amendments. That's where we are kind of it feels like we're like right in the middle of like a whole lot of uncertainty. That's what it feels like to me anyway. Is that where we are in terms of the way the legislation, the next stage?
Yeah, that's what I understand. Basically, the government has made, I think, some really sensible changes so far. But they've also really clearly said, we've made these basic changes and we want to show you that we're listening. But also they've said, now we've made those first set of amendments, now we want to see what that Senate committee says. And so while the bill is in the Senate, that's still an opportunity for government to keep thinking about this, for the senators to keep thinking about what they think might need to be done, and for that committee to be really informing what the fixes or the tweaks to the bill might be. And it means that there's still room for people like yourselves, like us, to be talking to government, to be saying, look, here are some things we really want to be making clear that we care about.
Mm. And so there were senators from every flavour as part of the Community Affairs Committee. And so I think this will be an opportunity for all of the different parties to make their amendments in the Senate. Is that right? Potentially.
Well, I mean, exactly. A majority of senators can make amendments to the bill. And so I think, you know, it's the government's bill and they will probably be the ones doing the hardest thinking about that. But of course they need votes from other places to get things through the Senate. And that means that a democratic process gives a voice to the opposition, to other parties, the Greens, the Independents. There's room for those conversations to happen.
One area of concern related to how the NDIA and the CEO in particular could request information for reassessments. That's been looked at in an amendment. Are you satisfied with that, Elle?
Oh, look, I'll defer to Mitchell on the details of what's happened in terms of those technical amendments. We had a couple of really big concerns around the proposals for the CEO to basically turf people out of the NDIS for not following some pretty arbitrary and harsh rules, given the people with disability that we represent, who often live in boarding houses, often have low literacy, often don't answer the phone or have a phone or will open a letter or necessarily be able to get reports and information in short time frames. We thought that was pretty harsh. And so the way we talked about, there was a bunch of those kind of ones, one about correspondence and there's one about the assessments and about reports that, you know, it just kind of, it sort of framed a way that disabled people's lives work that I don't know many disabled people whose life work like that. So it really was out of step. It might have suited a bureaucrat in terms of people administering the NDIS, but we think it was way going too far. But Mitch, have they fixed some of that stuff or made some of them a bit less harsh?
Yeah, so I think there are the bill in its original form gave powers to the NDIA to request all kinds of information from participants in situations where either the NDIA was considering kicking someone off the scheme, they could ask for information about making that decision, and also to ask for information where they're building a plan. Now, there's lots of suggestions that have been made about what needs to be, how those powers need to be constrained so that they're not having really rough consequences on people with disability who have a hard time complying with those or who might have really good reasons why they don't want to give up certain information or don't want to submit to certain kinds of assessments. The government's amendments on that point do something quite specific. What they do is they put constraints on when the government can force you to do a mandatory medical assessment when they are considering kicking you off the scheme. Now, they say they can only get that kind of a mandatory medical assessment in circumstances where they really need to, where there's no other reasonable way to get that information. It sort of says that mandatory medical assessment will be a last resort kind of power. That's a good thing. That's a good constraint to have. But what they haven't done is they haven't said anything about the other kinds of information requests that they could make. It still leaves the NDIA able to make a lot of really kind of far-reaching requests from people. It still leaves really harsh consequences if you can't comply with one of those requests or you don't comply. And it still leaves open the possibility of those mandatory medical assessments for people who are having their plan built. The agency could still say, if you want to get your new plan, you still need to go to this assessment with this professional without that constraint, that last resort kind of guardrail. So what I would say about those constraints that they've added in those amendments is they're good. They're a first step. And what I do take away from this is, well, that shows me that government realises that there's concern about those information gathering powers and that there's a need for constraints. But I want to see more. I would want to be seeing some of those other sort of guardrails to prevent those powers from being misused by an over-enthusiastic NDIA staff member.
I feel like you're saying that a lot, Mitchell, about these are a good first step. He's much more diplomatic than I am. But we're waiting to see much more kind of comprehensive amendments that really come to grips with, you know, I mean, the way that we talked about it. So DANA, the organisation that I represent, our members are individual disability advocacy organisations. And so the people with disability who often come to advocates are people who don't have families or don't have anyone else to support them. And so we were thinking often about people who live in boarding houses, for example, and so people who don't necessarily know how to engage with a government system and would find that kind of hoop extremely difficult to jump through, but also that the consequences of them being turfed off the NDIS would be catastrophic. And so really trying to get the agency to really understand that, yes, it might be more convenient for them. And the examples that the agency has been using is particularly around parents of kids with disability, that they're not able to contact them or they can't, they just have to roll over their plans. And I'm like, okay, well, that, you know, you might have put, that might be your example, but the people with disability that we're thinking of who are going to be much more, you know, deeply impacted by this are not, you know, they're not who you've thought about when you've been framing this legislation, which again is part of the sausage making process where, you know, they put up one set of facts and we come back and go, yeah, you kind of forgot about this bit as well.
There's been a lot of that, hasn't there? And there's real concerns around appeals and the ability to get your a replacement mid-professional or also to appeal the statement of support and the funding allocation. Has that been addressed, Mitchell?
The amendments don't do very much on this front. They do some helpful clarification. So it makes it clear that the way that government is thinking about replacement needs assessments is at the stage of building your plan, at the stage of getting an internal review, at the stage of going to an external review before a tribunal. They're saying at each of those points, they want the reviewer to be thinking about, does there need to be a new replacement assessment? Is the existing assessment wrong? And so they've made that clear with some notes to the legislation and some tinkering to the wording. They have tried to make it clear that the intention is not to say, oh, we want to block people from being able to do anything from their needs assessment. If you get a bad needs assessment, too bad, so sad, that needs assessment is God. They've tried to make clear, I think, with these amendments, that's not the thinking, and that's a good thing. Elle, I'm going to say again, it's maybe a first step, but it's probably not enough. I think that there are still rules to be made, NDIS rules, remember, between the state and the federal government that will set out when you get new and a replacement needs assessment and when you don't. I think that the ability to get a replacement needs assessment when the first one is wrong is so important to how your plan will look. Is so important to a plan that could go for, you know, 5 years or something. There really need to, your right to a replacement needs assessment and the situations when you can get one, I think those really should be in the Act. At that very top level, there really should be something in the Act that says, these are the circumstances in which you can get a replacement assessment, and make sure that that's accessible to people, that it's something where you're able to make that kind of request and have a right to one. At a point where you can see that the first needs assessment has gone wrong.
And we kind of captured this particular moment in a couple of ways. We firstly went back to what the co-group said about needs assessment and the way that the co-group had originally envisaged needs assessment to actually include different aspects that, like a bit of self-assessment, going back to a really kind of older concept that we all talked about the very early days of the NDIS, but also taking this moment to kind of get something that we've all argued for a really long time, which is draft plans. And we wanted to kind of slip that in at both this needs assessment area, but also in the budget setting, like that you actually get a draft process. because it is something that we've argued for in just about every single inquiry into the NDIS, I think, for 10 years, that why on earth can we not have a draft at this point so that mistakes or things that are errors or, you know, small problems don't then have to go into the whole big change of circumstances and reviewable decisions and all of that stuff, but can actually be fixed before they go into place. But we certainly argued really strongly that, A, it should be a reviewable decision at, you know, every point, that, yes, you should be able to get a replacement. If it's wrong, we wanted a draft as well, and trying to put some elements in there around your choice of, like, which particular professional suits your particular disability, and that it can't just be some rando from the NDIA. It does the needs assessment. That they actually have to be people with significant qualifications, etc., and that the specifics are designed with us. Because one of the things that we learnt so much during independent assessments, and one of the key problems with independent assessment proposal, was that it wasn't anything to do with us. It was a proposal imposed upon us in terms of what the assessment was, who would deliver it, and then how the what the outcomes of that assessment would be used for. So trying to learn all those lessons from the independent assessments debacle and make sure that it's going to do what it's intended to do. And one of those things is to make things fairer, because at the moment there are people having to go through enormous cost to get the kind of right reports that say the right words or the right things so that they can get access to the supports that they desperately need. And for lots of folks, that's not fair. And so part of the co-group thinking during the NDIS review was, how do we actually make this process fairer for people so that you're not expected to have lots of money to be able to access the scheme? That feels ridiculous, given that disabled people don't have lots of money.
Mitchell, I understand that Dr. Ryan, who's a Member of Parliament, made some suggestions around amendments to improve the bill. They didn't get through. What do you think went wrong there, and do you think that we need more amendments to the bill?
Yeah, look, Dr. Ryan suggested quite a few amendments, and I thought that most of them were really, really sensible and thoughtful. I guess I'll pick out a few of them, and a lot of those amendments actually go to the topics, the big topics that we've been talking about. One set of the things that Dr. Ryan put forward would have implemented some of these co-design consultation type requirements for legislative instruments. Now, the government said they weren't prepared to support that because they said they thought it created a question of legal risk, that they said, well, maybe it might set precedent across the government that you always have to go through these really long processes and you're at risk of stuff getting declared unlawful. I'm not sure I agree with that, or at the very least, I would say I think there is room for, if government feels like the wording of that amendment that Dr. Ryan put forward went too far, I think there would be room to clarify or to tinker. And I thought it was a really sensible amendment that really goes to a lot of what we've been talking about today. A second set of the things that Dr. Ryan proposed was around for some of the powers that the agency will have. Saying, well, they can only use those powers to put conditions on things like how you spend your funds, where it would be unduly burdensome on a participant. So basically balancing the need to put that kind of condition in place against the burden it would put on the individual person. Now, that was something that PIAC, my team, suggested in our submission. We think that's a good balance. The government said, well, they thought it might be difficult to define, it might be difficult to do in practice. Again, I would say I think that's something where there's maybe room for tinkering, but ultimately, as we've said, we think there's room for more controls, more protections against some of these NDIA powers. The third big piece that I would want to talk about is there were some amendments there that would put rights to replacement assessments into the Act. Dr. Ryan moved that. Minister Shorten, in saying why the government didn't agree to that, said, I think quite interestingly, that they didn't want to encourage doctor shopping, people going from one report writer to another report writer to another report writer to get the thing that they want. Look, I think I'm prepared to say that there might be and perhaps there are instances that the government knows about where, bad actors try and take advantage of that sort of a process. But again, I think whether or not you agree with the exact wording of that amendment, I do think that there are ways to put this kind of right to a replacement assessment into the head legislation, particularly if government has designed these needs assessments in an appropriate way. If the design of the assessment in the first place is appropriate and fit for purpose, then you should be able to eliminate that prospect of doctor shopping to get the wrong kinds of or a manipulated outcome.
For people who are listening, you can't see my face, but my eyebrows are doing a lot of heavy lifting listening to Mitchell's explanation there. I think that the idea that people are not doing that now, you know, that people with money can go to the right doctor and spend $5,000 and get the right report and get better access to the scheme than someone who lives in Mount Druitt, Western Sydney, who is relying on the outpatient hospital system. Sorry, I'm just going to get on my high horse about equity and public services in a moment. I just think that, yes, there is inequity and there is doctor shopping by people who can afford to as we speak. And so I think it's really, yeah, I think we can absolutely find a way to make that, put that in the legislation. And I think we have to. Like, I don't think you can have a one and done. I just don't think that's possible, given the variety of people with disability, the need to increase the workforce kind of capacity to be able to deliver assessments in a fair way, the need to upskill the internal NDIA staff to be able to interpret the assessments, the ability to translate those into a budget. Like, there's a whole lot of things that depend on those needs assessments. So the idea that you wouldn't be able to replace them if something had gone wrong. We know that racism and prejudice and ableism come into, you know, the way that disabled people encounter medical professionals. We just had, you know, a large royal commission into some of these issues, particularly for people who speak and communicate in different ways, people from a culturally and linguistically diverse background, and, of course, First Nations Australians, where, you know, they don't encounter anything like equity. So I think we can make a very strong argument about the need to increase fairness in these and for that to be the fundamental principle for these assessments, because they are so integral to the way that a lot of these other settings actually will work. We have to make sure we get this process right.
Yeah, and Elle, I think, as you say, you know, the things like doctor shopping can happen at the moment. You might say, well, we want to eliminate that. We don't want that coming into this needs assessment process. And I think that's fair enough. But I do think there are ways that you can have your cake and eat it too. You can prevent that sort of doctor shopping without saying that means no one gets to correct a bad needs assessment. No one has those rights to protect themselves. You can do both things. You can walk and chew gum.
Yeah, 100%. 100%.
There was one other big issue that was in those proposed amendments by Dr. Ryan that I do want to touch on, and this is maybe one of the biggest sort of philosophical issues that is still going, or sort of questions that really does go to what is the scheme for, and that was about this question of whole of person supports. Now, it sometimes gets called in different government reports the attribution issue or the access nexus issue. But basically, the bill as it's drafted says, if you have got five different disabilities and one of those, say, diagnoses that you have, one impairment set, has qualified you to get onto the NDIS, meets the threshold for you to get onto the NDIS, and the other four don't. At the moment, the bill says you can only get supports. Your support package will only be calculated by reference to that one qualifying disability. Now, that means that a person who is doing your needs assessment would have to do their very best to ignore the impact of those other four disabilities you might have and try and say, well, let's say you're a person with a psychosocial disability and there are a series of different kinds of things that a psychologist or a psychiatrist might say. And let's say you have five things, five diagnoses, and only one of them has been accepted as an NDIS qualifying diagnosis. But all of them need hours with a psychologist. All of them need various kinds of adjustments in your day-to-day life. All of them contribute to you needing supports. How are you supposed to slice up those hours into which ones go to this disability, which ones go to that one.
We come in nice boxes, Mitchell. Didn't you know that? We come in neat little boxes, specially designed for bureaucrats to tick all their little boxes. Sorry, yes. I think the whole of person thing is probably our fault because we put that in all of our submissions that they needed to attend to the whole of person. One of the other ones that comes up a lot with the primary and secondary disability has been, say, for the deaf-blind community where, you know, you cannot separate out, you know, being deaf and being blind because the cumulative impact of being deaf-blind requires specific supports and the supports that you get as a deaf person don't suit you as a deaf-blind person. And it's been, you know, or you're a person with intellectual disability and you're deaf and, you know, you've got different disabilities, this idea that we can come in these separate kind of compartments and that we all have like one disability is ridiculous. But it also, I think, we've been able to do this in other parts of government, but I think that the NDIS continues to try and separate these out. And it actually is the area that ends up in the AOT the most. It ends up in, you know, right up to federal court where people are arguing for that whole of person thing to say that the cumulative nature of disability, if you've got five different diagnoses, whatever they are, they impact, you know, together. And because, I don't know, they're all happening to the same person. Sorry, my face, you know, just trying to manage this stuff. And you can, yeah, imagine how good I am in consultations late in the afternoon. So, but I think this is where that kind of sausage making between the letter of the law, you know, of legislation and the reality of people's lives gets very difficult to square sometimes. And, you know, I have found a lot of this legislative process this bit quite hard because I think about the people that I know who are in these circumstances and then I'm like, well, that doesn't work. So,
and Ellie, you've said that better than I could, but I will say that the tribunal, when it's had to make decisions about this, most of the time that the tribunal's had to consider this, the tribunal says the same thing. You can't slice people up into these little artificial parts of their lives that a person is a person. When the Joint Standing Committee on the NDIA and the NDIS looked at this, they said, you've got to do this as a whole of person thing. When everyone who's looked at this, I think, who really gets into that issue tends to be able to see that it's kind of absurd to do that work. I think that's part of why Dr. Ryan could see that. She's a doctor, after all. She knows that when you treat a patient, you have to think about them as a whole person. And so I really do think that this is something that needs to be addressed, needs to be kept pushing on, because at the moment the bill would say you have to do that artificial task of dividing people up into which disability is which and which part of them is which and which need is which. And I do think that's something that that I'd like to see changed as the bill goes through the Senate.
The other big one for me was that there are proposals to introduce this new pathway for people with psychosocial disability in particular and potentially for children eventually. And but what they're planning to do, and we put a lot of time and effort into this, was to say the amendments that we proposed were all about foundational supports. Now, I know we've talked about that a fair bit around the NDIS review, talked about the system, the disability ecosystem, OASIS and DESERTS and all of that stuff, and how difficult it is to actually introduce a lot of these changes before any of those foundational supports are in place. And I think one of these things we've made particular recommendations about delaying that section of the legislation for several years, because it will be several years until foundational supports can be in place. So we have put a timeline on there and said you can't actually implement this until foundational supports are up and running and paid for and ready to go as part of that incentive to state and territory governments and Commonwealth to get a wriggle on around foundational supports, because if they want to make changes to who is eligible for the NDIS, we can't let that happen until there is some other support, because at the moment there is nothing. And so one of the things that I'll be really looking for in terms of the committee report is how much of that they've taken on board, because we did talk quite a lot about foundational supports. I got in a fight with one of the senators about the ILC program, the information linkages and capacity building program, and all of that. And so whether it's they actually take that on and all of our concerns, because I think that was in huge amounts of submissions, certainly was in all of ours, I know it was in yours, Mitchell, around how do we take people away and when the review came out, I was part of the big joint statement that we did. I think we ended up with like 70 organisations signing up to it to say, you can't make changes until there's something else. Like we won't stand for it. And it was really, really important that we kind of made that line in the sand. And that line in the sand is it's got into all of our submissions, and we all said the same thing at the committee hearing. So I think that that's a really important thing for the government to hear, the opposition and the senators as they're writing their report, that, you know, people with disability fought incredibly hard for the scheme and for the support they need to live their life. We're up for the reform to make things better, to do all of that, but we can't sort of fail at the first hurdle to kind of make it unfair now. There's so much more work to do. We've got to take our time and do it carefully to make sure that we don't make mistakes and we don't have, well, I'm not going to say unforeseen consequences, because we can absolutely foresee the consequences, but we don't hurt those disabled people who need support the most while there is absolutely nothing else available in the community.
I want to ask both of you this question. Based on the legislation as it stands, does it need more amendments? Mitchell.
Yeah, look, I think as we've been talking all the way throughout, I think I've been flagging there's quite a few places I think the bill could still be improved. There are other amendments I'd like to see. Maybe the biggest sort of principle I'd like to see inserted there is some more of these requirements for the minister to be making these determinations in conversation through engagement with the disability community. And I think that will go towards answering a lot of these. I think the whole of person questions, there's still amendments to be made around that. I think that there's really important other amendments around some of these ministerial or agency powers that put more constraints, more guardrails, more protections around those. I'd really like to see a lot of those different things, those conversations that I think have been started by some of these amendments at the first stage. I'd like to see that continue through the Senate process and for the bill to keep being improved to make sure that it ultimately isn't producing something that either comes out of the box bad or that can be used in the future to undermine the scheme and undermine the rights of people with disability. So, yeah, I think there's room for more.
Well,
yeah, well, look, agree with Mitchell, who's, of course, much more accurate and tempered, as a lawyer should be. Look, we are really keen to see the committee listen to the disability community, to have read all of our submissions, and we tried to be extremely helpful to the committee and make lots of suggestions about the kinds of amendments they could make. So I am very much looking forward to their report. But yes, the bill does need much more amendments than it currently has, and I'm confident that that is going to happen. But we'll see in terms of, look, if the committee came down and said there will be no more changes, and we don't recommend any changes, I'd certainly be extremely annoyed and wouldn't support it then, but we actually need far more changes. So let's wait for the committee hearing on the committee report on the 20th and, yeah, see what they say.
Right, so there's a Senate committee report coming down on the 20th of June. And that will make recommendations around what needs to happen to the legislation.
Yeah, and so what we're hoping is that the government will pick that up in the Senate, and as they take the bill forward in the Senate from the 24th of June, they will pick up the committee's report and take on those amendments. That's certainly the most optimistic proposal, and one that we're working on now.
What if they don't, Al?
If the committee comes down and say the bill is fine, it's going to be devastating. You know, it's kind of like that part where you just go, really? You really didn't hear us. You really didn't listen to the experts, people with disability, you know, our friends at PIAC, our friends, you know, the admin Irish lawyer from La Trobe, you know, who have been really clear, who've tried to be as constructive and helpful as we can be. I will be pretty devastated. But, yeah, you know, what we've said to our community and what, you know, people have said is that if the committee comes down and says, no, the bill's fine by itself, no, we can't support it in its current form.
That's all.
Look, I think I'd really fall in behind Elle on that. I think it's a bill that the disability community has to be comfortable with. And I think, as Elle says, there's plenty of things that in its current form, I would absolutely understand. A person with disability looking at this and saying, oh, I don't feel like I want to go forward with that. I don't feel like I'll be comfortable living in the world that bill will make. As I said, I think I do. I do really hope that the position we're in, where government has said this is an ongoing conversation, this is something where we want to be listening to your feedback and improving the bill. I hope that's right. I think if the committee came back or if government came back and said, that's it, no more changes, we're done here, then I would feel pretty disappointed that there hadn't been that willingness to take on board the pretty consistent feedback on some of these points.
Any final words? And I'll start with you, Rich, because I want to give Elle the last say.
Look, I think it's... I'll keep it as short as I can and say I think it's a good thing that there have already been amendments that show at least the general concerns are being heard. I don't think all the amendments go as far as I want them to, but they do show that there is an acknowledgement of where those areas that need more work are. So I encourage the disability community to keep on it, because I think that I think we've identified the spaces that really need to be nutted out here.
Yeah, look, I agree that it's a good sign that there has been amendments already and that they are in the right direction. But we do need to see much more. I think the consistency among the submissions was unusual and very close. I think we all had picked up the same elements and had the same problems and then the same suggestions for change without really talking to each other much in the meantime. So I think it shows that for those of us who have been watching and looking and thinking about the NDIS for a long time, we have all picked up the problems and have all suggested things to make this bill better. So I am watching closely and hopefully, with my fingers crossed, that the government takes these on. But, you know, I totally understand that everyone's nervous. I'm really nervous too. So it is feeling like a bit like we're walking a bit of a tight wire at the moment. We are right in the middle of the sausage-making process and it's pretty awkward and messy. So, yeah, we'll just have to continue sitting with a bit of uncomfortable, awkward and messy for a while. We've got a few more weeks to go of this bit of it. And then potentially a little bit longer to go around getting into the nitty-gritty, depending what happens, of the rules themselves.
Yeah, thank you both so much for your analysis today, and also for the work that you do day in and day out around the rights of people with disabilities. It's such important work, especially right now with the NDIS bill. And I just want to also say that it is a hard time for our community, so we're in this together, right?
For sure.
Thank you guys for coming on the show, and we'll see you very soon.
Thanks, George.
Thanks, George.
That's what we have time for on today's episode of Reasonable and Necessary. As you know, we love your feedback, so please share your thoughts with us in the comment section below. Thanks for listening. And until next time, stay well and reasonable.